Just over 2 weeks ago, baptized members of the church observed the New Testament Passover as instituted by Jesus Christ. On that Thursday evening, we read many encouraging verses, words from our Savior as we commemorated both his death and resurrection. At the conclusion of Passover service, we follow the example. It's written in Mark and Matthew. I'd like to go to Mark 14, Mark's account first. We follow an example that the disciples did, Jesus Christ, at that first Passover, in singing a hymn and then departing for the evening. In Mark chapter 14, verse 26, it says, "And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives." For you and I, this is where we end Passover service. You know, we have a build-up to that evening, and then we all come here, and we wash feet, and we take the symbols of the bread and the wine. We read a lot of scriptures, and then we read a verse like this, and then we sing a hymn, and then we go home. We usually encourage everybody to just, you know, depart quietly, go back home, reflect upon the evening. But it doesn't end there. If we continue reading, notice verse 27, because immediately after this, we see something develop. Mark 14, verse 27. "And then Jesus said to them, 'All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. But after I've been raised, I will go before you to Galilee.'" Notice here now Peter's response. And Peter said to him, "Even if all are made to stumble, yet I will not be." That's a pretty strong statement, right? It's like, I don't know about the rest of these guys, but as for me, I will not be made to stumble. Jesus said to him, verse 30, "Assuredly I say to you that today, even this night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." That's not good enough for Peter, because he responds, but he spoke more vehemently, "If I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And then, of course, the disciples have to jump in here. Yeah, neither will we, right? And they all said likewise. That's human nature, right? I wish I'd have said that first, right? So then they all join in. Let's read Matthew's account over in Matthew 26. Matthew chapter 26. We'll begin in verse 30. Matthew chapter 26, here again in verse 30. This is usually where we go. We usually go to Matthew 26, 30 on Passover. "And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives." In verse 31, "And Jesus said to them, 'All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee.' And here Peter answered and said to him, 'Even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble.' And Jesus said to him, 'Assuredly I say to you that this night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times.' And again Peter said to him, 'Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you.' And so said all the disciples." How many times in your life have you heard somebody say, "I would never," just fill in the blank, whatever follows. And then when you hear that, you say to yourself, "Oh, you better watch out." Right? Anytime we do the "I will never," right? And then somewhere later on in your life, maybe you're confronted with that thing you said you would never, whatever, and now you're in a quandary because you're remembering, "I said I would never, and now I never thought about this scenario coming up, and now what do I do?" There's that saying, right? Never say never, because you just don't know. Barclay's study Bible makes an interesting point. Barclay says, if a man says, quote, "This is one thing I will never do," that is often the very thing against which he must most carefully guard. Barclay says, again and again, castles have been captured because the attackers took the route which seemed unattackable and unscalable. The very spot where the defenders didn't even guard, because there's no way anybody can get in through that way. Barclay concludes, Barclay concludes by saying, Satan is subtle. He attacks the point at which a man is too sure of himself, for there he is likeliest to be unprepared. Notice something in Luke's account. Go back to Luke 22. We have an event in Luke chapter 22. We know as we went through those scriptures of the Passover, you know, Jesus told his disciples, you know, what I am doing you do not understand, you know, you will know after this. You know, these are some of the instructions and admonitions he gave to them. He also reminded them that a servant is not greater than his master, nor is one who is sent greater than one whom sent him. But here in Luke chapter 22, we won't go through the chapter. We see in verses 14 and 16, he emphasizes, Jesus does his desire to eat this Passover with them. Verses 17 down through 20, he gives them the symbols of the bread and the wine. And all this, he's instructing them as he goes through this. He goes on to speak about being betrayed by one of his disciples, verses 21 and 22. And then in 23, notice, we see then they began to question among themselves which of them it was who would do this thing, or who was going to be the one to betray. And then verse 25, or verse 24, we see another dispute arises amongst them as to which would be considered the greatest. You know, when you think about that, here on the very evening that Jesus Christ is telling them what's going to happen to him, and he gives them these very symbols of his body and the blood and what it means, he teaches them about foot washing and being humble. They're disputing as to who's going to be greatest in the kingdom. You know, I often wonder what they must have been thinking at that moment. On one hand, they must have been excited because he talked about his kingdom and they would have a place in his kingdom. They would be ruling over the tribes. They would be judging. And so they probably had an idea of what they thought they were going to be doing. So much so that they began to wonder which one would be greatest. I'm going to drop on down to verse 31, because Jesus Christ now is going to go speak directly to Peter. Luke 22, verse 31, the Lord said, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he might sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail, and when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. Peter said to him, Lord, this is the same Peter, right? Everybody else may deny you, I'm not going to. Lord, I am ready to go with you both to prison and to death. And then he said, I tell you, Peter, the rooster shall not crow this day before you deny three times that you know me. You know, think about this for a moment. You know, here, as I said, they were probably on some degree of excitement. They're going to be rulers in the kingdom with Christ. I mean, it must have been somewhat encouraging to them. And yet we're going to see that shortly thereafter, Peter's going to, I'll use a modern day term, he's going to kind of crash. He's going to realize that he was warned about something and it's going to come about. You know, Jesus had pressed upon his disciples that they needed to have the heart of a servant. And yet, still at Passover, they begin to debate. Okay, yeah, but which one will be the greatest servant of all, right? It's like, it seems like an oxymoron to some degree. Go back again to verse 24. Luke 22, verse 24. Now there also was a dispute among them as to which one of them should be considered the greatest. Again, I'm puzzled every time I read that. My only takeaway is that's human nature. I mean, if we're honest with ourselves, I don't know that it's easier to look back and say, oh, that I wouldn't have done that if I was there. I don't know that that's true. I mean, I think it just speaks to what human nature is. You know, they're all over there talking. He said, we're going to be kings. Which one of us is going to be greatest? And what of us is going to be like? But it turned into a dispute. Jesus Christ, who just told them, I come among you as the one who serves. And you guys are arguing over who's going to be first. Who's going to be the greatest. It's almost as if they didn't get what he was telling them. And so it's right after that that he says to Peter what we just read, right? Peter, not once, not twice, three times, you're going to deny me. The word for deny that he uses there, you can look it up on your own, literally means to deny utterly or to disown. Peter, you're going to disown me. Now that, to me, that's a stronger word than just deny. You're going to disown me. It's a pretty strong statement to tell Peter. Let's go back to Luke 12, because that word is used again in an earlier spot. And I've often wondered if Peter thought about this when Jesus Christ made that statement to him. You're going to disown me. Luke chapter 12, verse 8. Also I say to you, whoever confesses me before men, him the Son of Man will also confess before the angels of God. But he who denies me, same word, he who disowns me before men will be disowned, denied before the angels of God. Makes you wonder, did that word resonate to Peter? This is a strong statement. Peter, you're going to disown me. Not once, not twice. Three times. And then if he's thinking, you know, back to this, does that mean that Christ will deny me three times? Disown me? I think it had an impact on Peter. If I was Peter, I'd be kind of shaken in my boots, to use a modern term. I'd be a little bit scared of what was about to happen. If we go back to Luke 22, I'm going to read the end. We'll come back and we'll read the whole account here in a little bit. But notice, we see, of course, in Luke 22, verse 60, that it does, in fact, happen. Peter said in verse 60 of Luke 22, this is the third time, I do not know what you are saying. And immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. So put yourself in a scenario like this. How would you feel if you had that warning and yet it came to pass? What can we learn from this brief little encounter in Luke 22? Because on the surface, it seems discouraging, but I submit to you that we'll see there's actually encouraging words in here from Jesus Christ to Peter that often gets overlooked. Can we actually draw encouragement out of what is said here? I've titled the sermon this afternoon, Don't Be Too Sure of Yourself. Don't be too sure of yourself. Go back again to verse 31. The Lord said, Simon, Simon, indeed, Satan has asked for you that he might sift you as wheat. Why did Satan ask? What motivated him to ask? Whom did he ask? These are questions that we should consider. What occurred to cause Satan to ask? Let me at this guy. I think it goes back to verse 24 that we just read. There was a dispute among them as to who would be greatest. And Satan probably said, oh, I know this one. Right? What did he want? He wanted to be on God's throne. He wanted to be elevated. So he probably thought, oh yes, let me in here. Give me a shot at these guys. And I think it's entirely possible that as he saw this dispute amongst the disciples, he saw an opportunity to sift them. We know over in James 4, we've read James 4 many times. Let's read it again, because again, it speaks about where disputes, where wars come from among us. James chapter 4, beginning of verse 1. Where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and do not have. Right? Which one of us gets to be greatest? There's a dispute. You murder and covet, cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss. That word for amiss literally means with wrong motives intent. You're asking for wrong reasons. That you may spend it on your pleasures. Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you think that the scripture says in vain, the spirit that dwells in us yearns jealously, but it gives more grace. Therefore it says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Verse 7, therefore submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. The corollary might be, don't submit to God, dispute amongst yourselves over who's greatest, and you may not be able to resist the devil. And so I think the disciples' argument over who would be greatest, this is a matter of pride, I think really was the door that opened up this opportunity for our adversary to ask permission to sift Peter like wheat. You know, when I think about that event, and here they're disputing over who would be greatest, you know, Jesus Christ is about to die a horrible death, and they're fighting over what they're going to get out of this. Reminded me of my days when I was doing financial advisor at J.P. Morgan, and people would fight over mom and dad's assets, and they're not even dead yet. They're coming in, they're talking about, yeah, they're in hospice or whatever, and they haven't even died, and yet the family is fighting over who gets what, and I don't think they meant it to be that way. And you're just sitting there going, they're still in the hospital. And say, I think about that because that's what they were doing. Jesus Christ just said, I'm gonna die this horrible death. And they're fighting. And we'll see here in a moment, I think, that Jesus does a very deliberate action with them to try to teach them a lesson, that it's not about them. It never was about them. Well, they were gonna have a role, but you know, he was going to correct them here in a moment. So the door was open, they were disputing, and I believe our adversary decided this was an opportunity. I've got a chance here because there's this warring and disputing going on, and so I'm going to see if I can't get in there and see what I can do about it. Again, Barclay says, if a man says, this is the one thing I'll never do, that is often the very thing against which he must most carefully guard. I will never deny you. Oh, really? Never? And we'll see that's what he's going to be tested on. If you remember on the first day of unleavened bread, and I think a couple years ago, I've spoken many occasions about the two kinds of testing in the Bible, the two words, dokimatsu and parezo. I've covered that before. Dokimatsu is the one that speaks primarily of God. Right? When he tests us, it's with the intent of us passing that test. It's given with the idea that this is something that is sort of measuring your achievement. It's not intended to break you. The other word is the one our adversary speaks mostly of. That word is parezo, and it literally means to the point of breaking you. That is the intent when a test comes in that regard. He wants to break us. Here in Luke 22, we have another word. It's sift. That word is sift. That word there is syniadzo, and it's not translated test. It's translated sift. And this is the only place in the Bible the word is used. It was interesting because how often do we talk about God sifting his church, right? It's a term we often use, sifting. But yet, this is the only time it's used, right here when speaking to Luke, where Satan is asked to sift you like wheat. Thayer's definition means to sift or shake in a sieve. It means inward agitation or to try one's faith to the verge of overthrow. To try your faith to the verge of overthrow. Sodiety's word study means to agitate and prove by trials and afflictions. So our adversary in this account is asking to try Peter's faith to the point of overthrow. Thinking about what we read in Luke 12 and what was said to him in Luke 22, I imagine Peter at this point is probably a bit scared, maybe discouraged, thinking, okay, what have I done? You know, am I able to get through this? I mean, imagine Jesus is telling you Satan has asked permission to sift you as wheat, and the part that's not stated there is, and the Father has said, okay. Right? He has to get permission to do that. I'd be quite discouraged if it was me, if I was in that circumstance. I'd be nervous, wondering how this is going to play out. Jesus Christ knew that discouragement was something they were going to have to deal with. Let's go back to Matthew 26. He's going to give them an example. I believe this is deliberate, what he does here, Matthew chapter 26. He just told Peter what he's going to have to deal with. And I believe what he does next is to give him an example of how to deal with it. In Matthew chapter 26, we'll begin at verse 36. So here, remember, this is right after he told Peter, right? You're going to deny me. You're going to disown me three times. Then it says in verse 36, Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to the disciples, sit here while I go and pray over there. So I think he's going to show them, this is how you get through periods of sorrow and discouragement. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee. I believe there's a reason he did that. We'll get to that in a moment. And he began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed, and he said to them, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me. He went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed, saying, oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. Verse 40, then he came to the disciples, and he found them sleeping, and he said to Peter, what? Could you not watch with me 1 hour? Just 1 hour. And again, watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Keep in mind, this is right after he told Peter, Satan is asked to sift you. And so he's showing him a way through this. Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, the flesh is weak. Again, a second time, verse 42, he went away and prayed, saying, oh, my Father, if this cup cannot pass away from me unless I drink it, your will be done. And he came and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. And so he left them, went away again, and prayed the third time, saying the same words. And he came to his disciples and said to them, are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand. The Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. I believe he took those three to teach them a valuable lesson on how to get through challenging situations. Jesus used the term, I am exceedingly sorrowful. And so his example to them is, this is how you get through it, right? You take it to the Father. You know, get on your knees, take it to the Father, you know. And so that's the example he's giving to them. Let's go now to Mark 10, because I believe there's a specific reason he took those three, Peter, James, and John. We know our adversary has a lot of power in the world today. He is called the God of this world, the prince of the ruler of darkness. He is prince of the power of the air. But he has a lot of power, but his power is still limited. He's still, again, under God's authority. God's supreme over all. But we'll see here in Mark chapter 10. We'll begin in verse 35. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him saying, teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. And he said to them, what do you want me to do for you? They said to him, grant us that we may sit one on your right hand and the other on your left in your glory. And so here we have this request. Other accounts say it was the mother that brought them. Commentators disagree on what that looked like. I imagine mom and the boys are all coming forward, and it's semantics as to who was asking. The request was the same, one on the right hand, one on the left. But Jesus said to them, you do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And they said to him, sounds like Peter, right? We are able. Right? Don't be too sure of yourself. Sounds a lot like Peter's response. No hesitation, absolutely, we're able. So Jesus said to them, you will indeed drink the cup that I drink, and with the baptism I am baptized with, you will be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared. And notice verse 41, and when the 10 heard it, they began to be greatly displeased with James and John. Right? Here's the source of this dispute. Oh, why didn't we think of that? And who do they think they are to ask to be sitting on the right hand and left? And then, you know, this is human nature right here, right? This is how it still exists today. They got upset because those two guys went up and asked. And I, of course, this is where I kind of read into it and think, yeah, there's probably somebody else that simply was saying, we should have asked first, and why them and all that goes with that. So this is the source of this dispute. Who's going to be greatest? Who's on the right hand? Who's on the left? Who's first? And so To me, it's not a coincidence at all. In fact, I think it was deliberate that he took James and John, these two, and Peter, who also maybe thought was a little bit too sure of himself and said, I need you three to come with me in the garden. Maybe he felt they needed that object lesson more than anyone else. I think those three men were maybe at the heart of the whole dispute. Who's going to be greatest? Who's going to be first? Let's go back now to Luke 22. As I mentioned, there is actually encouragement in this verse that we often read past. In Luke 22, verse 31, well, again, Simon, Simon, indeed, Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat. So, again, I've mentioned this earlier. Whom did he ask? Who did he make this demand? Well, obviously, he took it to God. We see that back in Job. If you want to look at Job, we can just briefly look at Job. We'll look at chapter 1 and chapter 2, just some highlights. You know, God, Satan goes about to and fro, but he'll bring these petitions to God. In Job chapter 1, verse 6, it says, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? And so Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth on it. Now the commentators say that the terminology is there is, I'm going around looking for things that I can get involved in. Like I'm trying to stir up, that's what he's doing. He's not on a nature walk, right? He literally is on an agenda, looking for opportunities. And that's why I said, when you come to Luke 22, I think that's what he came upon. Oh, here's an opportunity. It's exactly what I've been going to and fro looking for. And the Lord said to Satan, verse 6, have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil? And Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for nothing? And again, he goes on to talk about, you've put a hedge around him, you take that hedge away, and we'll see what happens. We'll jump over to verse 2. Again, same thing happens. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, verse 2, from where do you come? And Satan answered the Lord and said, same phrase again, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. I'm looking for opportunities. And as we read in Luke 22, it's you and I that give opportunity depending on how we're behaving, right? Do we provide opportunity? The Lord said to Satan, verse 3, have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God, shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. And so Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin, yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, he's in your hand, but spare his life. Again, Satan came to God and asked permission to go after Job. And God allowed it with conditions, right? Can't take his life. I don't believe God would have allowed it if he didn't feel like Job could handle it. And I think the same is true for you and I. Our adversary has to get permission. And as we look at that word sift, it's to the point of overthrow, but not to overthrow. And so we may be challenged from time to time in our lives. Why would God allow these types of things to happen? Why would he allow us to go through various trials? Well, certainly to teach us lessons, right? If we're arguing and disputing amongst ourselves, right, we'll learn through that. But I think the most important thing is he is trying to purify the bride. He's trying to purify the church. He's trying to get the church ready, right? And we've got to be tested in all these things, right? Just as the disciples were told, you know, to be a servant. Don't worry about who's in charge. That'll come later. And so I think he wants to know what we're made of. And along with that, we should never think too much of ourselves, lest we have something come upon us because we think we've got, you know, everything covered. Again, that word for sifting, trying your faith to the verge of overthrow. That's our adversary's goal, to try to overthrow our faith. And so we need to be careful. Now, here's the encouraging part. Let's go back to Luke 22, 32. Chapter 22, verse 32. It's right after he said, Satan has asked you, for you that he may sift you as wheat. Verse 32, but I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. What better encouragement could you have that Jesus Christ would say, I've prayed for you that your faith will not fail? And notice what else he says. And when you have returned to me, not if you will return to me. He said, when you return to me, strengthen your brethren. It's almost a foregone conclusion that he's saying to Peter, you're going to get through this. Because he says, when you return, not if, he said when, he said you'll strengthen your brethren. I actually find that quite encouraging. It wasn't like, you know, human beings would say, yeah, somebody's going to put this trial on you. Good luck. That's how human nature is, right? Because that's about all we can offer. We can't step in and do anything about it. But here, Jesus Christ says, you know, I've prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you returned, you'll strengthen your brethren. So it's a when, not an if. I think that's an important distinction. I think that was very encouraging to Peter. You know, Mr. Orleman's sermon, that ties in well. You know, he talked a lot from Hebrews. Hebrews 2:18 speaks of being tested in all things. Let's go look at Hebrews 2:18 real quick. Verse 17, therefore in all things he had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God. We heard about that in the sermonette. To make propitiation for the sins of people, for in that he himself has suffered being tempted, he is able to aid those who are tempted. You know, he just told Peter, you're going to go through this trial, I prayed for you. And as we saw, we read earlier, he actually went and took him in the garden and showed him how to get through this. You got to pray, you got to take it to the Father, make your feelings, emotions, petitions known to God, and he'll get you through all of this. You know, for you and I, you know, there's often occasions in life where we ourselves would say, you know, I've been there, done that. I've had my share of trials. I've had those occasions where I maybe thought I would never fill in the blank, and then whatever that never is tends to surface in our lives. What Jesus Christ was telling Peter here was that when you suffer trials, it makes you equipped to help others who suffer similarly. Pick any trial. Pick a trial you've gone through in your life that makes you uniquely qualified to help somebody else who goes through a similar trial in a way that I couldn't. You know, if you want to take something as like a woman who has a miscarriage, I'm clueless there, right? I could try to understand and think I understand, but a woman that's gone through something like that can comfort somebody else that's gone through something like that. And so whatever we may have experienced in our own life makes us qualified to help others. And so we are strengthened as a result from it. Let's go back to Luke 22. Jesus Christ knows that Peter's going to deny him three times. And so he mentions in his, you know, statement to Peter, it's not a complete failure. You're not a complete loss here. It's going to be a temporary, you know, I use the term temporary lapse of reason, maybe, and you're going to falter and slip, but it's going to bring him to tears of repentance. Luke 22, now let's read the account as it plays out beginning in verse 54. Having arrested him, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house, but Peter followed at a distance. Now when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them, and a certain servant girl, seeing him as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him and said, hey, wait a minute, this man was also with him. Now, I can imagine him maybe sitting in the back trying to not be noticed, because it said he, you know, sat with them, but earlier it said he followed at a distance. But she said, this man was also with him, verse 56. But he denied him. There's that word, right? Denied him, disowned him, saying, woman, I do not know him. I don't know what you're talking about. Got no clue. And after a little while, verse 58, after a little while, another saw him and said, you also are of them. But Peter said, man, I am not. Again, just adamant, making clear that he's not related at all, doesn't know what they're talking about. And then after about an hour, verse 59, after an hour had passed, another confidently affirmed, saying, surely this fellow also was with him, for he's a Galilean. Peter said, Man, I do not know what you're saying. And immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. Imagine what he felt at that moment. Let's continue, verse 61. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, Before the rooster crows, you will deny me, you will disown me three times. I don't know what that looked like. You know, was it one of those when it happens, Peter looks at Jesus Christ and Jesus looked at him and kind of cocks his head like, I don't know, but there were no words. But he looked at him and Peter remembered what was told to him. Verse 62, Peter went out and wept bitterly. He knew. Again, Christ's admonition to him was, don't think too much of yourself. Right? Don't be so sure of yourself. Notice 1 Corinthians chapter 10. The Apostle Paul would remind the church of Israel's mistakes, and he would offer a similar warning about not being overly confident. You know, in our lives, there could be any number of things we might be too confident about. You know, we might think, oh, I've got this one nailed, whatever it is, whatever that may be. And it's always good for us to go back and review what we know and believe and what we hold, what we think to be true, to make sure that we're still abiding by every word of Scripture. 1 Corinthians 10. He begins in verse 1 by speaking, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud, into the sea. They ate the same spiritual food. They drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things, verse 6, became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. You know, again, he's saying that there are example, in essence, to the extent that we follow the example and learn from what happened. Otherwise, it's just a story in a book. But if we learn from it and don't repeat those things. Verse 7, do not become idolaters, as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did. And in one day, 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Or complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. Verse 11, now all these things happen to them as examples. Right? And as I said, they're examples to us if we learn from the example. Right? We all know you can learn from a good example or a bad example, right? You can learn from it. The bad example is you say, got it, not doing that, right? So you can learn either way. And they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the age have come. Therefore, verse 12, similar statement, right? Don't be so sure of yourself, right? He says, let him who thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. Don't be so sure of yourself. No temptation, verse 13, has overtaken you except such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Paul's letter here to the church at Corinth was very similar to Peter's experience. Let's not get too sure of ourselves, right? Lest we let our guard down, lest we no longer watch that part of the castle that we're sure. I mean, I got that one locked down, nailed tight. Don't have to worry about that one. You say, no, it's good to go back and revisit. Like, revisit our foundation. How are we doing? Are we still solid in what we believe? And we can prove those things. And again, so we're not caught off guard if deception should come, our deceiver who's looking to seize an opportunity. Again, if we have a relationship with our high priest, we heard about our high priest in the first message, he will intercede for us. That's what we heard in the first message. He will intercede for us. He's gone through sufferings. He will be there for us. Our adversary may ask permission to sift us, but it won't be something that we can't handle. The Apostle Paul to the church in Rome also wrote in Romans 12. Let's go over there. We can begin to wind down now. Romans chapter 12, a familiar section. But notice, in light of what we're talking about here, and not being too sure of ourselves, Romans chapter 12, verse 1, he says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. For I say, verse 3, through the grace given to me to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. But to think soberly as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. Again, we could all do well to not think too much of ourselves, right? It's good to go back and review what we believe and why we believe it. You know, I think there's a lot of encouragement to what Jesus Christ told Peter back in Luke 22, right? You're going to be tested. You're going to be sifted. Right? Your faith will be, you know, tested to the point of overthrow, but not to be overthrown. But you'll get through it. I've prayed for you, and I think our Jesus Christ intercedes for us to this day, as we heard in the first message. And as trials are come our way, he likewise has shown us what to do. Bring it to the Father. Get on our knees. Pray about it. Take it to him. I believe Peter learned a very valuable lesson. How do I know that? Let's go back to 1 Peter 5 and look what Peter wrote, because I think he learned quite well through what happened to him. I believe it changed him for the better. And as Jesus Christ told him, you're going to take what you learned, and when you return, you're going to go strengthen your brethren. And here we have written proof that that's exactly what he did. We're going to read this now. Again, this letter to the church that Peter writes is in the midst of a lot of trials. They're being falsely accused as evildoers. He told them to be willing to suffer for righteousness' sake in chapter 13, verses 14, 15, and 16. And now in 1 Peter 5, beginning in verse 1, he says, again, thinking about what he went through in Luke 22. To the elders who are among you, I exhort, I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed, shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. It's not about who's the greatest, who's the first, who's on the right hand, who's on the left. He said, you know, serve them. And when the chief shepherd, verse 4, appears, you'll receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. Likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Yes, all of you, be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility, for God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. Now, notice these words in light of what he went through. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour, looking for opportunity. I went to and fro, all the ends of the earth, I'm looking for opportunity. Resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. But may the God of all grace, who called us to his eternal glory, by Christ Jesus, after you have suffered a while, perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you. To him be the glory and the dominion forever and ever. Amen. Here he writes words to strengthen the brethren based on what he went through. So it came about exactly as Jesus Christ said it would. I think we can be encouraged by what happened in Luke 22, even though it was a test for Peter. I think the most important lesson, or one of the most important, I think we can take away from this, is that God will at times sift us or allow us to be sifted. But if we can hear the words that we read here and likewise learn from it, Peter wrote some encouraging words. You and I as well will be stronger for what we go through. We can encourage one another, other members who go through trials, as we can share what we've learned. The most important thing I think we can see from all of this is that when we've endured this sifting, right, as Peter's example was, we can do a much better job of supporting one another. So let us all be sure to never be too sure of ourselves.